volunteers to carry out the work of the station. We are always looking for new volunteers. We have monthly volunteer orientations, which is the first step in getting involved. Contact KBOO Volunteer Coordinator Ani Haynes about the next volunteer orientation at 503-231-8032 extension 231 or at volunteer@kboo.org.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is 11 a.m. Disability awareness is off today. Instead, we'll hear an excerpt from Letters to Washington, featuring an interview with Rebecca Williford, attorney with Disability Rights Advocates, about what happens to people with disabilities during natural disasters. At 11:30, Roberta Hall hosts Health and Healthcare Forum with guest Dr. Ted Shetler. Don't miss it. Stay tuned.
This is Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Well, one thing we can assume safely is that in the Philippines, after Hurricane Haiyan, the people most affected are going to be the elderly, people with disabilities, and the poor. And we know that that's not so unusual because the same dynamic happened last year here in the United States in New York City after Hurricane Sandy. In fact, last week, a federal judge in New York ruled that New York City and its disaster plan was out of compliance under such things as the Americans with Disabilities Act. Well, for more on all of this, I'm joined by Rebecca Williford. Rebecca Williford is a staff attorney with Disability Rights Advocates, and she was an attorney who worked on this case. Rebecca, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Mitch, for having me. Happy to be here.
Good to have you here. Talk to me about what happened to disabled people after Hurricane Sandy in New York City.
Great. Well, again, thanks so much for having me here. And Disability Rights Advocates, DRA, here in Berkeley, is a national nonprofit legal center representing the rights of people with disabilities.
And you were working on this case in New York.
I was. We're based
here.
And
it was a class action lawsuit.
Yes, yeah. That's correct.
Yeah,
that's correct.
And we'll talk about the organization in a minute, but tell me more about this actual case. Tell me more about the people who are part of this class action.
So the DRA represented actually four clients. We had two organizational clients and two individuals. Tanya Morales and Greg Bell were the individuals. Tanya Morales is a woman who lives in Brooklyn who uses a wheelchair and has a hearing and speech disabilities. We had actually filed the lawsuit after Hurricane Irene, which hit back in 2011. And Tanya had had a very difficult time getting into an accessible shelter during Hurricane Irene. She found that the accessible entrance to the shelter was actually locked, and she was not able to get into the shelter. And so our other plaintiff, Greg Bell, is blind and has diabetes and PTSD. He's a Vietnam combat veteran. So both of our individuals represented a variety of, of disabilities and issues that the city needed to plan for. We all, because it was a class action, we also represented two organizations, Brooklyn Center for Independence of the Disabled, or BCID, and then Sydney, which is Center for Independence of the Disabled in New York. And those are two independent living centers in New York.
So in your experience on working on this case, tell me, generally speaking, and maybe you can use a few examples, but when you talk about Tanya already, who is one of the main defendants, or not defendants, one of the main people in this case, but talk to me about generally what happens with people with disabilities when you do have a natural disaster, whether it be Hurricane Sandy or Katrina or whatever it may be. What is that that happens?
So unfortunately, many terrible things happen to people with disabilities, and so just a few of those. I mean, if a city has not planned in advance and made plans from everything from evacuation to shelters to communicating with people about what the plan is. And we're talking about all sorts of disasters, those that strike without warning and those that we see approaching for weeks.
But here in California, we get earthquakes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so one of the more compelling stories from our Hurricane Sandy clients in New York was a man named Kenneth Martinez, who was living in the low-lying area. He uses a wheelchair. He's an amputee. He lives on the first floor of his apartment building. He tried to evacuate when the call went out to evacuate, but he could not. The buses that were coming were not accessible to him. He could not get accessible transportation out. So he was stuck alone. And eventually the storm, the hurricane hit, the storm surge came in, the water was rising. He floated out of his wheelchair.
Floated. Because of the water.
His apartment flooded. And he was at the ceiling of his apartment, banging on it, and it happened to be neighbors upstairs who heard him and came down, broke a window, swam in, and pulled him out in the nick of time. And he, you know, he survived, but
right.
There were reports of death. You know, people with disabilities and the elderly are the folks that unfortunately get left behind when there are not plans in place to get people out.
And is that what we found in New York City? Is that what the judge found, was that New York City did not actually have plans for dealing with its disabled and elderly
citizens? Yes, the judge pointed out several areas where the plans were deficient. And you know, some of those areas were evacuation, particularly high-rise evacuation.
Many people are stuck in their building because the elevator.
Right. So, you know, we had another client, Melba Torres, who lived on the Lower East. So Kenneth Martinez was stuck on the first floor and flooded and almost drowned. Melba Torres was stuck on the top floor of a high-rise building, and the elevator went out. She's another a wheelchair user. Who relies on attendant care, and she was trapped for 6 days with nothing. She happened to get lucky enough that her attendant could stay with her.
Yeah.
But most people are not that lucky, and there are no plans in place.
And we heard a number of those stories after the Hurricane Sandy happened, that there were people, disabilities, elderly folks as well, who were stuck in high-rise apartment buildings, couldn't get out.
Right.
You have a lot of people who are in subset of public housing,
yes,
that are high rises that were stuck in that.
Yeah, we had class members who lived in the NYCHA, the New York City Housing Authority buildings, who were just stuck. They weren't getting
not even plans for the folks that were living in public housing.
Correct.
Where you know you have
a
good
Absolutely.
Concentration of people who have mobility difficulties.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just very, you know, the consequences are tragic.
Is New York City alone and not having plans?
Unfortunately, New York City is not alone. So DRA has done work in some other cities in this area. Here in California, there were we brought a case against Los Angeles, both the city and the county. The county settled with us, and the city actually required litigation, and DRA won a motion on summary judgment and are now working to craft a remedy with the city of Los Angeles. DRA also had to file a lawsuit against the city of Oakland, but then that very quickly became a collaborative working relationship.
To come up with a plan. In Oakland.
Right. In Oakland, yes.
That's where I live. So I'm glad to hear about that.
Yes.
Again, we are in conversation with Rebecca Williford. She is a staff attorney at Disability Rights Advocates. She was one of the attorneys who was working on a case in which last week a federal judge in New York ruled that New York City was out of compliance. And it was out of compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Also, the Rehabilitation Act? I mean, it was several laws that the city was seen to be out of compliance with.
Sure. We brought the lawsuit under three different statutes, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Rehab Act, and the New York City Human Rights Law. And the judge found the city was liable under all three of those statutes.
Now, because it's a federal judge in Manhattan, Where does that apply anywhere outside of New York?
Well, that these decision? Well, the so the decision is specific to New York City, but it sets a precedent for what other cities across the U.S. who are subject to the same Americans with Disabilities Act have to do.
Now, I imagine one argument is that a disaster is a disaster. You can't fully prepare for a disaster. And oftentimes, especially here in California, where you have earthquakes, you never know when a disaster is going to come. It's one thing to enact disability rights laws or accessibility laws when things are working normally in your everyday life. It's another thing when everything's gone crazy and everything's destruction's all around you. I mean, how would you respond to that type of an argument?
Sure. Well, some of what we're asking for in the lawsuit is just a disaster is a disaster, and it's tragic. But some of what we are asking for is very basic access. For instance, in New York, they rely on inaccessible subways to get people out of to get people out of danger during emergencies. There has to be a
And understanding the subways in New York City, about a tenth of them are probably have elevators to begin with. And for those that do have elevators, they never work. They're always out of service.
Yes, unfortunately. That's
I know this from personal experience, I could say.
I do too, all too well. You know, so New York City is also relying on its inaccessible public schools for shelters.
Yeah.
These are things that the city can think about ahead of time and should have made plans to do. You shouldn't be in a situation where someone, you know, the only means out of a death situation is not accessible.
So planning is a big issue around this. You plan for this. I guess one of the issues that came up is how do you identify who is going to be or who is disabled and who may need to be – the city may need to be aware of during a disaster.
Right. So there are some different ideas out there. Some cities allow people to sort of self-identify as somebody who wants assistance. Not everyone likes that idea. The other thought is to just communicate the plan for accessibility to everyone, because you never know where you'll be in an emergency, and you may be with a person with a disability. You may have a family member with disability. You know, everyone should know what the plan is, and it should be, you know, in the heat of the moment, you shouldn't have to wonder, okay, where is the next accessible shelter? It should just be accessible.
Yeah. As somebody who works on disability rights legal issues, we're talking about this case in New York City and other cities as well concerning disaster planning. Do you see this issue, what you're working on, does it go beyond disaster planning? Is it a bigger issue about accessibility, the city?
I think that disaster planning you've got the sort of coming together of so many different government services and infrastructures. And you've, you know, also got interactions with private entities, you know, contracts for, you know, providing prescription medications and emergency things like that. So I think there's so many parties that have to come together for emergency planning. And when disasters strike, systems that are already fragile, like providing attendant care, you know, often just crumble.
Yeah.
So you see the real pressure points on the system.
Rebecca Williford, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Again, Rebecca Williford has been our guest. She was an attorney working on a case in which, again, last week, a federal judge ruled that the city of New York was out of accessibility compliance concerning disaster plans. She is an attorney with Disability Rights Advocates.
We're used to media scaremongering over Social Security. The program is about to run out of money, so benefits must be cut. But lately, a different Social Security story has caught on, this time about Social Security disability benefits. This story is also about money. The Trust Fund for Disability could run out of money in 4 years, we're told. But the story is that there's been an alarming and somehow suspicious explosion in the number of people getting disability benefits and the supposed ease with which almost anyone can get that money. That was the message that was sent loud and clear by a recent CBS 60 Minutes broadcast. Rebecca Vallis is the Deputy Director of Government Affairs at the National Organization of Social Security Claimants Representatives. She's here to talk about what CBS got wrong. Welcome to the show, Rebecca Vallis.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, this segment opens with Steve Croft. He's sitting in front of a backdrop that shows hands reaching for dollar bills.
Mm-hmm.
Disability has, in his words, been called a secret welfare system with its own disability industrial complex, a system ravaged by waste and fraud. This is not exactly subtle. So broadly speaking, what was it that CBS got so wrong or misrepresented so badly in this broadcast?
Well, I'm really glad, Peter, that you started with that kind of setting of the stage, that dollar bills falling into hands. It was all very sensationalized. And I think that that really set the tone for the whole piece. Unfortunately, the 60 Minutes piece was incredibly misleading. It was inaccurate, but it was also incredibly one-sided, and it was really missing many essential facts about the disability programs as well as the people that they help. And I have to say it was surprising and really disappointing to see 60 Minutes repeat so many of the same myths and inaccuracies as the NPR and Planet Money series that ran earlier this year on the same subject, given that that NPR Planet Money series was so widely discredited. So I guess it was no surprise that the 60 Minutes report itself was also quickly denounced by fact-checkers and disability advocates who understand the programs apparently much better than 60 Minutes producers.
Now, the first sort of unchallenged assumption in the piece is that it's really easy to get disability benefits. There's a judge who's quoted in it and says, if the American public knew what was going on in our system, half would be outraged, the other half would apply for benefits. You have people who work in the benefits claims processing offices saying 30, 40, 50% of the people who come in absolutely don't deserve disability. CBS is sitting in front of a Walmart parking lot saying, because they were told when the checks go out, the Walmart parking lot is full of people who, the implication is, don't deserve disability but love the free money. How hard is it to get disability?
Part of what was so fascinating and disappointing about 60 Minutes reporting here was that it was almost entirely based on unsubstantiated rumors and on speculation, and that they then used those rumors and speculation to draw broad, sweeping conclusions about the entire Social Security disability programs without even pointing to any evidence of anything. The real story of the Social Security disability programs is that it's incredibly hard to qualify for benefits. According to the OECD, we, the United States, have the most restrictive and least generous disability benefit system of all member countries apart from Korea. Fewer than 4 in 10 applicants are approved for benefits, even after all stages of appeal. And many people with significant disabilities and serious illnesses are denied benefits. So even the death rates are incredibly high of beneficiaries. 1 in 5 male and 1 in 6 female beneficiaries die within 5 years of being approved, and beneficiaries are more than 3 times more likely to die than others their same age. And those statistics don't even capture the countless number of people who die waiting to be approved for benefits, something that happened to clients of mine when I was representing individuals seeking disability benefits. So if the 60 Minutes producers had really talked to anyone who had been through the process of applying for benefits or who was a disability policy expert or who even had ever helped a loved one seeking to go through the process, they would have known you don't just sign up for benefits. You know, really nothing could be further from the truth.
And the target in the piece was this lawyer who sort of fit, you know, right out of central casting, sort of a lawyer villain. He's got TV commercials where he promises you're going to get your disability checks. He refuses to sit down for an interview, talks to them in the parking lot. It does give you the impression that this anecdote that they're pursuing so doggedly illustrates a larger problem. And I think that's one of the most dangerous parts of this broadcast. The spike in disability enrollment is arguably what set some of this all off. And it's not that that's made up, but that there is an explanation for why more people are on disability now than were 10, 20 years ago, right?
I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, again, if 60 Minutes producers had actually spoken to the Social Security Administration, and in particular to their actuaries, they would have found that the growth in disability insurance was not only expected, but is almost entirely the result of demographics. And in really leaving that out of their reporting, instead of really telling the dog bites man, but more the man bites dog story, 60 Minutes really demonstrated a pretty blatant ignorance of well-known facts about the program. They posed the question, where did all these people with disabilities come from? Well, if they had actually done some research, they would have found that that question has been asked and answered time and again. First and foremost, it's the baby boomers aging into their high disability years. In addition, it's women who entered the workforce in significantly greater numbers in the 1970s and in the 80s, and so now they can qualify for disability insurance based on their own prior contributions. And thirdly, we've raised the retirement age, which means that people who qualify for benefits on the basis of a disability continue to collect disability benefits for longer before they convert over to retirement benefits. So it really seems that 60 Minutes was looking for a sensational story because the real story isn't all that sexy.
And we should note that this story seemed to be based on the research of a right-wing Republican Senator Tom Coburn, a climate change and debt ceiling denier. So it gives you some sense of the political angle here. And that's what I was thinking about as I was watching this broadcast, is that, you know, 60 Minutes is still considered the kind of gold standard in broadcast news. But the story doesn't start at 60 Minutes. It doesn't end at 60 Minutes. It does suggest that there are some powerful forces who want to push certain policy outcomes. Do you get the sense that disability benefits are now kind of on the menu of social insurance programs that are old-fashioned and too expensive and must be cut back?
Well, you know, it's heartbreaking to take a look back at history and to see that this is hardly the first time that we've seen this play out. As recently as the mid-90s, we saw a drumbeat of negative media around the disability programs, and as a result, there was legislation by anecdote that Congress pushed through. Later on, it turned out that the media reports that had formed the basis for a huge media feeding frenzy were unsubstantiated. But it was too late because Congress had already acted and had significantly cut benefits for over 100,000 children. As I said, we've seen this before. I think we know how this story ends if we don't put the brakes on and say, let's not rush to implement policy by anecdote. Let's actually take a look at the facts. Let's not look at individual anecdotes and then try and scale up and assume that the entire system is broken. Let's be more careful this time.
We've been speaking with Rebecca Vallis. She's the co-chair of the Social Security Task Force at the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. Rebecca Vallis, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Peter.
This is Health Bites from Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Life expectancy has been increasing. This is taken as a sign of better health. That's a mistake. A recent study suggests why. Published in the Journal of Gerontology, the study by Eileen Crimmins and Hiram Beltran-Sanchez found that while life expectancy increased over the decade from 1996 to 2006, so did the number of years that people will spend with disease and disability. You might think, well, sure, you live longer, you're bound to spend more time sick. But that's not necessarily true, and it misses the point. What these researchers are saying is that while years are added, even more of those years will be filled with suffering. For example, a man who was 20 years old in 2006 will live a year longer than a man who was 20 years old a decade earlier. However, the number of years he'll spend suffering from a disease or disability will be 2 years more than the 20-year-old of 10 years ago. In other words, a year of life was gained, but 2 years of suffering were added. One step forward, two steps back. This is far from the common assumption of 30 years ago when the expectation was that the marvels of modern medicine would not only continue to extend life, but prevent the ravages of aging and chronic disease. In fact, quite the opposite seems to be the case. discussion swirls around issues such as overdiagnosis and overtreatment, as well as the possibility that we've saved those who would otherwise be dead and instead sustained them in a state of chronic illness. I don't disagree with either idea. I'd add that the very practices that keep us alive cause us to descend into infirmity. I'd also add that environmental exposures in the broadest possible sense, not just what we're used to thinking of as pollution, but the proliferation of stress-inducing forms of technology in our personal and collective life, have been increasing with well-known effects. But there's an obvious one that the researchers themselves point to. While conventional science has triumphed at the heroic task of keeping the machinery of the human body going, it has failed utterly in preventing the onset of the chronic illnesses and disabilities that require those heroic interventions. Too much treatment, not enough prevention. Too much medicine, not enough health. Sounds like a good title for a book. I'm going to make a leap here to another report that came out last week. This one, published in Chemical and Engineering News of all places, describes the rapidly advancing science of the human microbiome. This is the study of all the microorganisms that live on and in us symbiotically and with us form an ecology. We literally couldn't live without them. And they're not just in our gut. They're everywhere doing all sorts of useful things with and for us. It turns out that every human microbe ecosystem is unique. There are similarities, to be sure, just as there are similarities among ecologies. The redwood ecology where I live is similar to, but not the same as, the redwood ecologies further up the California coast. The point of which is that ecologies work through complex interactions, an interesting topic in itself, but what it highlights for me is that chronic illness is a disruption of a complex ecology. Instead, the conventional way of thinking looks at chronic illness as a matter of treating one thing with one intervention. The concept of metabolic syndrome is a good example. Over 20 years ago, Gerald Reven, a Stanford cardiologist, observed that the people who were more likely to have heart attacks also had subclinical symptoms of metabolic disruption such as insulin resistance, inflammation, and high blood pressure. He called it Syndrome X. He pointed to this complex of symptoms as indicating a deep imbalance in energy metabolism that ought to be the appropriate object of treatment. In other words, it was a complex phenomenon with many interconnected elements: energy metabolism, immunity, circulation, digestion, and hormones. The imbalance doesn't come out in one way, but many. For example, along one path, heart disease lurks, while along another, diabetes. Conventional science didn't know what to do with this idea, so it renamed it metabolic syndrome and made it about obesity. The treatment became nothing more than a collection of treatments for the symptoms. Only now, they didn't have to wait for a full-fledged diagnosis to intervene. They could launch someone on statins or hypoglycemic drugs before that person was officially diagnosed with heart disease or diabetes because the patient had metabolic syndrome. This counts as prevention. The possibility of a new way of approaching chronic illness was lost to a commitment to well-worn pathways. That approach has failed. That failure is an example of the unexamined life. What begs for examination is our ecology, which is where and how we live and who we live with, whether it's our microbe fellow travelers or the people who are our co-conspirators, or the technologies to which we become extensions, or the natural wonders we inhabit with inattention, or the effluents from our way of life that come back to bite us. Understanding that takes us beyond a science of health that has its origin and logic in patching soldiers back together so they can be thrown back into battle. So we live longer and as a consequence suffer even longer. For every year we go on living, we lose more to illness and disability. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
And this is KBOO in Portland, Oregon. Coming up, more on the disability and health. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University with 5 part-time MBA programs that combine classic business skills with an emphasis on creative thinking, ethical decision-making, and sound judgment. the hallmarks of a liberal arts perspective. December 5th information session in the evening. Details at merrillhurst.edu. And by the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde Vocational Rehabilitation Program, providing assistance to eligible tribal members with disabilities on regaining, retaining, and securing employment particular to their strengths, capabilities, and experience. Information at grandronde.org or 1-800-242-8196.
My guest today is Dr. Ted Shetler, and he is both a medical doctor and has a master's of public health. And his main work now is with science and policy and environmental health. So welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're at the Oregon Public Health Association conference. It's October 14th, 2013, and he just gave a keynote address to an audience of about 500 people. A very wonderful talk, Connecting Healthcare to Public and Environmental Health. The main theme was that medicine and public health diverged in the early 20th century, and he wants to reconnect them. Tell us a little bit why you want to do that.
Well, I think that the separation that occurred early in the 20th century between medicine and public health was actually an artificial separation. It was done for political, economic, and social reasons, as well as professional reasons. And it may have made some sense at that time because medical care was not well regulated. Medical education was not well regulated. Clearly, there needed to be some improvements in health care. But to some degree, while those issues were addressed, the disconnection between medicine and public health did not serve us well. And I think many committees and scientific academies have realized that over the years that medicine and public health are really connected, should be reconnected, and that continue the disconnection and the misallocation of resources has not served us well. Just to give you an example, we spend